I had originally hoped to use this time to try to distill into an hour a sense of who the Rav was. When I began trying to organize my thoughts, I realized that even superficially, even schematically, it was obviously impossible, even just giving Rosh HaPrakim, to try to accomplish that. So as a result, I'd like to try to focus on two or three isolated points and fully aware, and as I'm sure all of you are, that it won't add up to any kind of comprehensive portrait. Any discussion of the Rav has to begin with the defining characteristic, his defining characteristic, and that is that he was a Godel Shebegdolim B'Torah. I'd like to try to explain a little bit what that term means, at least as applied to him. You know, it's a term which is used and bandied about rather freely. And I'd like to try to, again, a little bit explain what that means when we describe the Rav as such, as having been an Anok Sheba Anokim in Torah. And it's very difficult to do in this generation. Because people your age, the age of the Talmidim, who didn't know the Rav, not only don't such individuals exist today, I'm not even sure that the Hasagas, I'm not even sure that the conceptions of that magnitude of godless exist anymore today. So it's very difficult to try to communicate. But nevertheless, let's try a little bit. Let's begin first by trying to explode a myth. There is a myth. Again, one can't talk about the Rav without also talking about his roots, without talking somewhat about Brisk, about Volozhin. So there is a mistaken notion that Brisk neglected, or Achman Letzlan was even mezalzel in Bikiyas. There is such a prevalent notion. And this is absolutely untrue. What is true, and one sort of heard this in between the lines of different comments which the Rav would make, is that Brisk took Bikiyas, familiarity with knowledge of Kol HaTorah Kula on its most basic level, for granted. It wasn't that Brisk was mezalzel in Bikiyas. It's that wasn't the definition of godless. That was a precondition to one's aspiration to godless. But the Bikiyas was taken for granted. For instance, the story is told, it's quoted as well, that Reb Chaim once pointed to Reb Velvel when he was a young boy and said with clear pride that he knows Shas with Rashi. Similarly, I forget where I saw this, that Reb Chaim used to learn two Starim a day, and in each Seder, again, he would cover 20, 30 blot. So it wasn't the question of being mezalzel and bikiyas. Reb Elchanan, I think, in Kiddushin, quotes from Reb Chaim, the Gemara in Kiddushin and Daf Yud, talks about that someone who's a boki b'chol HaTorah Kula can be dana kal v'chomer. So dana kal v'chomer seems to be something which is restricted to a rather narrow context. So why does it require a bekiyas and kol haTorah kula? So Rabbi Chanan quotes from Reb Chaim that to be done the kal vachomer, so all you have to do is be sharp. But to know whether or not there's a pircha, to know whether or not the svara is correct, whether or not the svara can withstand scrutiny, so that requires the bekiyas and kol haTorah kula. And Brisk didn't stress bekiyas, it didn't talk about bekiyas, it didn't display bekiyas, but not out of any sense of zilzal or neglect, because it was just taken for granted. It was taken for granted. Another aspect or element of the approach of Brisk, and this had its source in Volozhin already, in its attitude towards Talmud Torah, was that the ultimate in Talmud Torah, the apex in Talmud Torah, was Chidushei Torah. Now, to understand the significance of that, if you contrast that with the approach of Eli Gadol, say someone like the Chazon Ish, so it's quite clear in various places that the Chazon Ish sees as the ultimate Birur Halacha, Halacha Lamaisa, and he quotes Gemaras which he feels corroborate that position. And in Brisk, but again, I think it basically has its source in Volozhin. That's what Reb Chaim Volozhin writes in Nefesh HaChayim, just for instance, in Shar Dalet, Perek Yud Beis, V'kol shekein chidushim amitiyim da'oraisa ha'mischachin al yedei ha'odam, ein aroch legodel noraos neflos in yonam, ufulosim lamala. Shekol milo milo pratis ha'mischadeshes mipi ha'odam, kutshu brichu noshik la uma'ater la. V'nivne mimena olam chodesh b'fnei atzma, v'hein hein ha'shamayim ha'chadoshim, v'ha'oretz ha'chadoshu sh'omer ha'kosuch. And Reb Chaim Volozhin continues. That's why, for instance, the Rav used to write down Chidushei Torah. He didn't make a habit of writing down his tshuvas and his piskei halacha. There are a handful of tshuvas which he had to write up fully for purposes of dissemination. But in terms of his own records, his own ksavim. So his own ksavim were Chidushei Torah, not the tshuvas which he gave, the psakim which he rendered. Now this is not to say that the Rav didn't invest and devote a lot of time to answering shailas. He certainly did. He spent endless and countless hours hearing shailas, thinking about them, weighing them b'kovod rosh and paskening. None of this is to imply that he wasn't involved, and that, as the Rav himself, using the phrase which the Gemara attributes to David HaMelech, as he said autobiographically, that yadai meluchlachos b'dam shvir v'shilya, that his hands were dirty with the practical nitty gritty of dealing with shailas and halacha l'maaseh. But he did so, again, out of a sense of service to the klal, out of a sense of responsibility to provide leadership for the klal, not so much as the ultimate fulfillment of Talmud Torah. But he did, and this needs to be emphasized as well, but he did see it as a sacred obligation to Paskin Shailas. He was very makbid on the Hefkerus, which he saw in America in the area of Paskining Shailas. And he used to say that in America, you would say in Yiddish, so yada eine Paskin fazich, that everyone Paskins for himself, that the Balabatim Paskin for themselves, and the Rabbonim who are not necessarily of the caliber to be paskening the types of shayas which they are, that everyone paskens for himself. And he said it very plaintively, very painfully, that there was a hefkerus, there was a lack of kovod rosh in the area of psak halacha in America. It's certainly not true. The contention that the Rav used to encourage everyone that they should paskin for themselves, and that is certainly not true. Perhaps one of the sources for the misunderstanding is that there were occasions when the Rav wouldn't paskin. For instance, it would happen from time to time that the Rav would get a shaila from someone from whom he had never had a shaila before. And it wasn't someone who was a Talmud of his, it wasn't someone who had any connection to him. And it was clear to the Rav, he had this uncanny sixth sense to know whether people were coming to him because it was an especially difficult shaila, which needed his psak, or they were coming to him because they had an idea of what psak they may get from him, which they wouldn't have gotten elsewhere. And on those occasions, so then the Rav refused to take out the shaila. He refused the paskin. So he would ask, very often he would ask, who's your Rosh Yeshiva? And then say, well, you should be asking him this shaila. Once, someone from a certain Hasidic group, the shaila in question was about adoption, whether or not there are Isurei Yichud between adoptive parents and children. So they called the Rav, and the Rav had never heard from this person before, despite the fact that the person had had many occasions to ask shailas of the Rav. The Rav had never heard from him before, and it was quite clear that the person was shopping for a certain psak, which he thought he was going to get a kula from the Rav, which he wouldn't have gotten elsewhere. And the Rav told him, no, you have to take this shaila to whomever you generally ask your shailas. So there were occasions where he deferred shailas, but that was for a totally different consideration, because one has to be consistent in how and of whom one asks shailas. And when the Rav detected that there was an inconsistency, so then he would not get involved. Another element of the brisk tradition which the Rav imbibed and subsequently personified is one which has become so fundamental that I think we can't even appreciate the profound influence which Reb Chaim exerted here. And that is, I remember once the Rav, he was asked to a little bit to explain about Derech HaLimud, so he said that his father used to say that you have to learn with the following assumption, and that this is what underlies the Derech HaLimud, and said something which seems so simple and so obvious and so self-evident that it's almost meaningless. But his father used to say, a Rishon can learn, that the Rishonim knew how to learn. Rashi knew how to learn well, and the Balei HaTosfos knew how to learn well, and the Rambam knew how to learn well, and the Rav knew how to learn well. Okay, so that's a Derech HaLimud. That's an even partial explanation of Derech HaLimud. So we know that that Rashi and Balei HaTosfos and all the Rishonim are all in good standing with us. But the truth is, if you step back for a minute, so what the Rosh Father was saying was something very profound. If you look, even in the generations, the Gedolei Lita, right before Reb Chaim, I'm not talking about going way back, but the Gedolei Lita right before Reb Chaim, you look at the Mishkanos Yaakov, you look at the Shagas Aryeh, you look both at their tshuvas as well as their chidushim. So if you look in the Mishkanos Yaakov, so Mishkanos Yaakov deals with the classical questions. They're not new contemporary questions. He's dealing with classical questions, on which, on most of these questions, just like the Shagas Aryeh in his Sefer, he's not breaking new ground in terms of the questions he's dealing with. He's dealing with old questions, questions which were already taken up by the Rishonim. And usually what happens in these tshuvas of the Mishkanos Yaakov, of the Shagas Aryeh, is that they end up being machriya. They say there's a Gemara here, which certainly proves that Rashi is right in this machlokas, and therefore halacha kamalsa. And in this machlokas, so there's a raya from the Gemara here
like the Rambam,
against the Rosh, and therefore we paskin this way, we don't paskin this way. And you look, none of this detracts from the Gaonus of the Svarim, of the Mechabim, but in terms of the approach is that they're Machriya, by basically being Dolche, one side, in the Machlokes Rishonim. And that was prevalent. And Reb Chaim, as we all know, and again, this has become so fundamental and so basic to the way we learn that we don't even realize the tremendous influence which Reb Chaim exerted here. But when Reb Chaim came and said, no, they're both right. Reb Chaim said, no, it's not that there's a Gemara which is like the Rambam, which is against the Ravid, that there's a Gemara which is like Rashi and which is against Tosis. Right? That was one of the most basic axioms within Reb Chaim's approach, was that both Rishonim have a consistent, internally consistent approach which works through all the relevant Gemaras. And that's what the Rav's father was saying when he said that, again, in terms of the Derech HaLimud, that it's based on this assumption as a Rishon can learn in. So it's not so posh to say, well, the Gemara and Megillah here about Kiddushas Beis Medrash proves that the Rambam is right, that Tefillah is Daraisa, and against the Ramban, that Tefillah is only Derabbanan. Along the same lines, there's another comment from Reb Chaim, which should be understood in this respect as well. And here too, again, when placed in context, it represents something new and not at all trivial. I think Reb Elchanan quotes a comment from Reb Chaim that we're not mechadshim, right? Not the comment one would expect from Reb Chaim. That the Rishonim were Mechadshim. But we, so our job is only to say pshat, to understand what the Rishonim were Mechadish. So what does that mean? And again, what was Reb Chaim conveying in saying that? So again, if you look in the Shagasayis Svarim on Shas, Gvuras Ari, and his other Svarim, so the Shagasayi, and again, not only the Shagasayi, many of the Gedolei Achronim, so they often, they'll have a Kasha and Rashi and Tosis, and then they'll say a new Pshat, a new Mahalach in the Gemara. Not Rashi, not Tosfos. So in Reb Chaim, Kemat you don't find it. You Kemat don't find that Reb Chaim says a Pshat directly in the Gemara. And that's what Reb Chaim insisted upon, that part of our tradition is, part of the tradition is that we see the Gemara through the lens of the Rishonim. That's what Reb Chaim had in mind by this comment recorded by Reb Elchanan, that we don't say Chidushim, we only try to say Pshat in the Chidushim of the Rishonim. The Rishonim were Mechadshim. The Rambam could come along and be Mechadish and say, no, this is the Pshat in the Gemara. The Ramban could do that. Our task is to see it through the lens provided to us by the Rishonim. Now this approach to learning has implications in Psak Halacha as well. And that is, given this Derech HaLimud of the emphasizing the Elu Ve'elu Divi Elokim Chayim as true amongst the Rishonim as well, not just amongst the Tanoim and Amoraim, but amongst the Rishonim as well, so then one, it becomes much more natural, again, what's associated with Brisk, but it has its roots in this Derech HaLimud, the notion of being Machmir for both Shittas, the notion of being Yotze L'chol Adayas. So again, it's not stam to be machmir, but rather it has ultimately, it has its roots. Part of it is a trepidation of horah, but in addition, it also ties in with the Derech HaLimud again. Of if the Derech HaLimud is the elu va'elu divi elokim chayim, it becomes much more natural to be machmir for both opinions in a machlokas, and one is much more hesitant, much more reticent about being machriya like one or the other. But this notwithstanding, that tendency was much more pronounced in the Beis Harav by their own personal hanhogos than it was in terms of psak l'rabim. For instance, I remember the Rav once commenting critically about someone who paskined that everyone has to be machmir for the Zmanei Rabbeinu Tam, for the Zman of Rabbeinu Tam, and on Motzei Shabbos not to do malacha until the Zman of Rabbeinu Tam. And the Rav said that his memory from his father's house was not like that. He said, of course, his father was very makvid on the Rabbeinu Tam's man, and he was as well. That was his Kabbalah. But it wasn't something that was paskined for others. So even though, again, this tendency was a direct outgrowth of the Derech HaLimud of Reb Chaim, but it was primarily one which was accepted for themselves, but not necessarily the psak which was given to the rabbi. So coming back to our original description of the Rav as a gadol b'Torah, as a gadol shebegdolim. So when one says that about the Rav, so you don't mean that he was a baki in Shas, in Rambam, in Shulchan Aruch, that he had a koach lasuke shmeitz alib de hilchasa, because all that was taken for granted. All that were the conditions, the preconditions for godless. That wasn't what the godless consisted of. Those were rather the tools. That provided the platform from which one tried to achieve and they attain godless. So what then was the godless? So the godless, and again, for the moment, we're speaking narrowly, just in the tchum of nigla. So the Rav once said about Reb Chaim, that Reb Chaim brought forth the neshama of Torah. That when Reb Chaim learned, when Reb Chaim explained, so he exposed, he penetrated to the neshama of Torah. What does that mean? So let's discuss a little bit, again, Reb Chaim's derech, because the Rav, obviously, even within the tradition in which he stood, obviously was unique, just as every Adam Gadol is. But nevertheless, one can't begin to speak of the Rav without talking about that tradition. So let's talk a little bit about Reb Chaim's Derech HaLimud. So it's well known that what Reb Chaim did, what we stumblingly tried to do as well, is that Reb Chaim was able to make that transition. He was able to make that leap from the concrete halacha, right, from what you saw on the surface, what you saw phenomenologically, to the underlying idea, to the underlying concept, right? Hence the description of conceptualization or abstraction. And that Reb Chaim's Gaonus, his Gadlus, and the Rav, like him in the famous letter of the Dvar Avram, so the Dvar Avram describes that which the Dvar Avram wrote in advance of the Rav coming to America. So the famous description the Dvar Avram gave was Nocha Olav Ruach Zekeno, that the spirit of Reb Chaim rests upon his grandson. So Reb Chaim's Gaonus, his Gadlus, the Rav's as well, was in being able to make this leap. When you learned with the Rav, you had the sense, it's like a golden touch. But sometimes, so we learn a Gemara, and, right, Rachman Litzlan, it seems to us, right, it can seem to me, right, lefi sichli hadal, right, it seems boring, Rachman Litzlan, right, we don't say it, but honestly, we do think it sometimes, right, it seems boring. With the Rav, there was no such thing as a boring line in the Gemara. Everything, the words were dancing. He had this amazing koach, and again, it was the koach to go from what was on the surface, right, which just seemed to be a dry halacha on the surface, and as he said of Reb Chaim, and to penetrate to the neshama, to the idea, to what was lurking, to what was underlying. But the gadlus and the gaonus was not only in making that leap. The gadlus and gaonus was also in the ability to notice things on the surface. And I think that is often not sufficiently emphasized. L'maisa, how did Reb Chaim learn? How did the Rav learn? So sometimes, and maybe this misunderstanding is created in part by how things are presented b'chsav in Reb Chaim's sefer, but too often we have the association with, well, chakiris, right? So that sort of captures or encapsulates the way Reb Chaim learned. That everything with Reb Chaim was a chakira in, is it chefze, is it gavra, is it this, is it that. But that's not at all the case. It's not at all the case. Reb Chaim didn't, the Rav didn't have any set questions which they asked when they approached the Blad Gemara. There was no, you know, when an Uman comes to do his job, so he has his toolkit. So the toolkit, there were no set questions in the toolkit, is it this or is it that? Rather, you learned, you opened the Gemara, you started learning. There were no chakiris. The godless was, again, so sometimes the difficulty, the catalyst, what stimulates you to probe to deep is obvious. Tosus points out Rashi's against the Gemara elsewhere. Okay, so that's a blatant difficulty. There, the only gadlus, the only gaonus you need is in resolving it. But what stimulates the catalyst is obvious. But again, the gadlus, the gaonus in Brisk was that even when others didn't detect any difficulty, others saw a smooth, smoothly paved road in front of them, so Reb Chaim sensed the bumps, and it was when there was a bump in the road, when the Blad Gemara wasn't smooth, so that's what prompted the rethinking and the re-examination of what are our assumptions, right? What are our assumptions that makes this difficult, and what does this point to in terms of revising our assumptions? So sort of after the fact, you can summarize that in the form of a chakira, but in terms of the process, the creative process, it's not a chakira at all, right? It's rather being stimulated by something in the words of the Gemara, in the Rambam. There's an extra word it might be, and sometimes again it was such a keen sense that others didn't even notice it. But it was always a response to something which stimulated it. And that's what brought about the rethinking, the re-examination. It wasn't, is it this, is it that? Sometimes you'll end up at the same finishing point. Sometimes you can begin either way, and sometimes you'll end up at the same finishing point, but often they will diverge. And that's also when the Rav would sit down, that's how also we learned. There were no questions. The Rav was very conscious of training Talmidim. Very conscious, again, of not just saying a shir, not just saying a shtikl Torah, but he was very conscious of a responsibility to train, right? In one of the Yahrzeit Shiurim, the Rav said, I think it's printed in the second volume, in terms of the definition of Rabbo Muvak. So there are some who say that Bizman Hazeh, that Torah Shebaal Peh is written down, so you don't have a Rabbi Muvak anymore, because most of what we learn on our own. And the Rav said that he didn't agree with that position. And he said it's true that if I would count the number of Blad Gemara which I learned with my father, as opposed to the number of Blad Gemara I learned on my own, so it's certainly true that I've learned more Blat Gemara on my own than I learned with my father. However, my father is the one who gave me the tools. My father is the one who equipped me to understand how to learn, how to understand, every blood Gemara which I learned on my own was due to the formative influence which my father had upon me in those blood which he taught me. And by virtue of that, he said, I have not the slightest doubt that he is Rebbe Mufak, even though the definition Chazal give for that is Rav Chochmaso Hemenu, and it can't be measured by how many blot did he sit and read with his father. But again, rather having given him the tools, having given him the Derech Halimud. And because of that, he was very conscious of, again, not just conveying the content of Torah, but also trying to train Talmidim, train the next generation, two generations, in knowing how to learn as well. And clearly saw that as, I have one particular comment which resonates now, but it wasn't intended to be repeated in public, so I can't. But he clearly saw that as, again, a primary task of a Baal Masara, again, not just to convey the content of Torah, but also the Derech HaLimud as well. But despite that fact, the way that was done was by sort of inviting people into the inner sanctum and letting them see the creative process unfold. It wasn't that there was any formalized methodology which you could, again, capture in certain key questions, because ultimately what the Derech HaLimud represented is a certain sense that there's more to this than meets the eye, that there's something deeper underlying this, and it's that sense, again, which is developed by exposure to someone who has it, and then by more and more learning. So, when we say that the Rav was a Gadol B'Torah, it means a Gadol B'Torah in this sense, a Gadol B'Torah in the ability to understand, again, not only the familiarity with the phenomena of Torah, with the halachas. No, that was the Bekiyas, which was a precondition to Gadlus B'Torah. But the Gadlus B'Torah was that ability to elicit the neshama of Torah, and to do so from brachos through uktzin, b'chol chadrei Torah. Here, it's worth digressing for a minute. You know, someone with the Rav's prodigious abilities. You know, the Rav used to tell the story about how he knew when he was in Berlin someone who had been a Talmud of Reb Chaim, and then subsequently had gone, he had studied math and science, and then he worked as an assistant to Einstein. And he used to like to talk to the Rav. And the Rav said that he was fond of comparing the two, right, Lahavdil, giants under whom he had studied. And that he used to say that if you want to rank them intellectually, in terms of the intellectual prowess of the two, so it's a fair question. Clearly, Reb Chaim was the greater of the two. Clearly, but it's a fair question. It's okay to raise the question. He said, but when it came to Chesed, so even though Einstein, right, was reputed to be a great humanitarian, so he said that Einstein wasn't ro'oi, he wasn't worthy to shine Reb Chaim Shuth. Wasn't worthy to shine Reb Chaim Shuth. The Rav also had very, very prodigious abilities. Now, one would imagine that with those prodigious abilities, one would easily rise to the top without necessarily having to engage in that amola shel Torah of being meimis atzma ba'ala shel Torah. And yet, I once asked one of my great aunts, she should be well, what her memories were of her older brother. So there was several years age difference, so she doesn't really remember him at age 8, at age 9. But she was only an infant then. Actually, this one, not even born. But she said she remembers she never saw him for a moment not learning. As a youngster, as a teenager, when she her first memories, she couldn't ever remember, searching back in the memory bank, always learning. Always either learning himself or learning with his father. There was never a moment when he wasn't learning. So, haga atzmucha. Again, the need for amolah shel Torah doesn't depend upon one's abilities. The need for amolah shel Torah is to make the most of one's abilities. And adarabah, the Rav apparently felt that the greater the abilities with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu blesses one, so then the greater the obligation and the more sacred the obligation, the more sacred the obligation to learn. And this continued throughout his life. It continues to times that I can remember as well. The same total preoccupation with learning, the same amolah shel Torah. The Rav used to like to say, Magala b'fume, I don't like to plagiarize myself. So most of us try not to plagiarize others. The Rav used to say, I don't like to plagiarize myself. What he meant was, well, he wouldn't have said it, but again, he was always, if Torah is Mayim Shein himself, so what that one has Chidushim al Gabi Chidushim in a particular sugya? No, that's what the Rav used to say, I don't like to plagiarize myself. Every time there was more and more to be discovered, and every time again, no matter how many years, no matter how many decades, there was the same Amolah Shel Torah to bring forth even more and more Chidushei Torah, not to plagiarize himself. Another perspective which it's important to have on the Rav, you know, Gedolei Yisrael throughout the generations, this is something my father, Zichrono Livracha, studied and wrote about quite extensively. Rubam Kekulam were preoccupied not only with Shas U'Poskin, but also with what my father used to call meta-halachic disciplines, which for some, like the Rambam, meant philosophy, and for others meant Kabbalah. And this was the tzura of, again, most Gedolei Yisrael throughout the generations. And certainly the Rav very much stood in that tradition of Gedolei Yisrael, again, whose range in Torah, again, exceeded just the tchum of Nigla, the tchum of Shas U'Poskim again, but in that very fundamental way, in the level of the neshama of Torah the Rav had, but also, simply put, that there was nothing that the Rav didn't know. You couldn't catch him on a Zohar that he didn't know. You couldn't catch him on a passage in the Mar Nevuchim, or the Kuzari, or the Likutei Torah, or anything. It was absolutely awesome. Really, the word is overused today. The word is stale. It was literally awesome. There was nothing. There was nothing he didn't know. And often, you know, Chazal say v'aleu lo yibol that afilu sicha schulin shal talmidei chachamim sicha Talmud. Sometimes, even more than when talking and learning about a particular sugya, when you really got a glimpse of the grandeur of his greatness, was in conversation. Because if you weren't limited to a particular sugya, but the conversation was sort of wide-ranging, So it was incredible. In the course of one conversation, and again, this was, it wasn't throwing around names. It was whenever it was relevant to the point. Every branch of Torah. Again, whether it was Hasidus, whether it was Musar, whatever it is, Kabbalah, the Chachmei HaMechka, the Rambam, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, Rabbeinu Bachya, everyone. It was absolutely, absolutely awesome. Now, these Gedolei Yisrael, who again, throughout the generations, and again, Rubam Kekulam, this is true of Rubam Kekulam, again, that they were Gedolim not only in the Yam HaTalmud, not only in Chochmas HaTalmud, but also, again, in the other disciplines. For some it was philosophy, the Rambam, for some it was Kabbalah, and for some, in the case of the Rav, it was both. So then the question arose, which again, the Gedolei Yisrael throughout the generations dealt with, is the relationship between these. The relationship between one's involvement, again, with call it the study of Halacha, the Yam HaTalmud, with, be it Kabbalah, be it philosophy. And much of this debate centered on how you learn Pshat in the Gemara at the end of the second parak in Sukkah, where the Gemara is describing the greatness of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And the Gemara describes how also Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he knew everything. And then the Gemara says, and he knew Dava Gadol, and he knew Dava Kata. He knew all the Dvarim Gedolim, he knew all the Dvarim Ketanim. So the Gemara says, what's Dava Gadol? What's Dava Kata? What are those terms refer to? So the Gemara says that Dava Gadol is Masa Mekava. The vision which Yecheskel beheld, which is recorded in Perek Aleph of Yecheskel, it's the Haftarah of Shavuos. And then Dava Kata, and the Gemara says, is Havayas Da Abaye V'Rava. Havayas Da Abaye V'Rava. So the Rambam says that what that means is that axiologically, that Masa HaMerkava is more important than Havayas D'Abaye V'Rava, which represent basically the Halacha part of Shas. That's what the Rambam says. And some others say that as well. The Vilna Gaon in the Bira HaGra in Yerodeya says it as well, but he takes the Rambam to task for identifying and understanding Maaseh Breishis and Maaseh Merkava in terms of philosophy, and says that is a terrible mistake which he thinks the Rambam made, that really it means Kabbalah. It means Chochmas HaNista. But others rejected that pshat entirely, and they say, no, that's not what the Gemara is saying. If you look, for instance, in the Ridva in Sukkah, the Kesef Mishnah in Hilchos Yisrael, the Torah quotes this Ridva as well, and he also quotes in Mizrahi, who says something similar, and they say that's not at all the case. Havayas D'Abaye V'Rava is treated as a Dava Katan. What it means is, in those places where a tradition was forgotten, where somehow or rather there were all kinds of sveikis, so that is referred to as Dava Katan. But Shas as a whole, Chochmas HaTalmud, is the greatest chokhmah that exists. And the Gemara in Sukkah is referring again to those areas where we're unsure, where our vision is clouded, where it's skewed. That's a Dava Katan. But in terms of Chochmas HaTalmud as a whole, that's a Dava Gadol. So for them, again, Nistar notwithstanding, Nigla remains the ultimate in terms of Talmud Torah, and the most important, even according to the other school of thought, just it's very important to clarify, even according to the other school of thought, so it's certainly the case, the Rambam says, that one has no right to progress to Maaseh Breishis and Maaseh Merkava unless one first is Milei Kreso Boso V'Yayin, unless one has first become a Godol B'Torah. So in terms of sequentially, there's no machlokes, but axiologically there is. And again, this is something which throughout the generations, different Gedolei Yisrael had different opinions on. Again, some saw, again, Kabbalah, Chochmas HaNistar, as being the ultimate Chochmas HaTorah. Again, one has to be roly to study it, and part of the qualifications is godless in Nigla, but again, in theory, that the ultimate is Chochmas HaNistur. And others say, no, that's not at all the implication of that Gemara in Sukkah. Interestingly, just to mention one such example, the Kesef Mishnah in Perek Beis of Hilchos Mamrim talks about how the Gemara says in the first Perek of Beitzah that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was matir an earlier gezerah with regard to Peros Netaravai, that even though min HaTorah the fruit of the fourth year, right, the fruit which is produced by a tree in the fourth year, which has the status of Revai, which is the same as Maaseh Sheni, so really, if you're outside of Yerushalayim, you're allowed to redeem it, and then bring the money and spend the money in Yerushalayim. So a takana had been made, La'ata Shukei Yerushalayim B'Peros, that if you lived within a day's journey of Yerushalayim, you shouldn't be poda your Revai, but you should bring it to Yerushalayim. And then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, subsequently, after the Churban, was matter this. So the Kesef of Mishnah, the Kesef Mishnah asks the Kasha and says, but the Rambam here explains that in order to overturn a Gezerah of an earlier Bezdin, you have to be Godel B'Chachma B'Minyan. You have to be greater than the earlier Bezdin in order to overturn the Gezerah. So how is it possible that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who amongst the Talmidim of Hillel, was the Katan Shebekulon? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he was considered the Katan Shebekulon, seemingly the lowest ranking amongst all the Talmidim, so how could he have been Godel B'Chochma B'Minyan than the Chachamim of an earlier generation, when even in his own generation, seemingly, the Gemara doesn't rank him first? So the Kesef Mishnah has two answers. One of them is Teida dehaka amah hasam shalohi niach memshalos kovsim mshalos shu'olim sichas shedim sichas malachei asharis u'masa mekova u'ba'osan chachmas efshe shehoyu gedolim mimenu avalo b'chachmas haTorah. So the Kesef Mishnah says that maybe when the Gemara says that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was katan shebekulon, he means he was katan shebekulon. He didn't have the same, his godless was a tiny bit less than their godless in things like Maaseh Merkava. But in Chochmas HaTorah, so then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was preeminent not only in his generation, but even klapei vis-a-vis earlier generations as well. So it's very interesting. Again, this Kesef Mishnah also seems to have implications for this question. The Kesef Mishnah seems to be saying that ultimately the status of Godel B'Chochma B'Minyan depends upon the Chochmas HaTalmud. It certainly would seem to have, not absolute, incontrovertible proof, but it certainly does seem to have implications for what we're talking about in terms of, again, axiological supremacy, again, of Kabbalah versus vis-a-vis Shas, vis-a-vis Nigla. So where did the Rav stand in all this? So I think one can fairly say, and again, and this is especially meaningful given the fact that he Mamish knew everything, again, that the Rav, again, was certainly of the opinion that Chochmas HaTalmud was the Ikar. The Chochmas HaTalmud was the Ikar. He certainly aligned himself with that group of Gedolim throughout the generations. Now here I'd like to, okay, now move on to the second point, but very quickly, very briefly, and try to give the Rosh HaPrakim of the Rosh HaPrakim. If one were to ask, let's say, if one were to ask about Reb Chaim, what effect did he have on the world? In terms of what? So clearly one would say that his Derech HaLimud he revolutionized the world in his Derech HaLimud. Right? It wasn't only, let's say we're now learning the second parak of Ksubis, it wasn't only the Chiddushei Torah about Shtaros, but the whole Derech HaLimud. The whole Derech HaLimud. Now obviously that Derech HaLimud then generates lots of individual Chiddushim. But in terms of on the macrocosmic scale, so certainly one associates with Reb Chaim the Derech HaLimud. Well, what if the same question is raised about the Rav? What Chidushim did he reveal to us within the Masorah? Again, a Chidush is something from within, not from without. But what Chidushim did he reveal to us within the Masorah? Again, clearly, the Derech HaLimud was Reb Chaim's. Two answers to the question, and I don't mean to suggest that these answers are comprehensive or exhaustive, they're certainly not, but just two answers, as food for thought, to think about. One of the things which the Rav said about Reb Chaim in the Hesped for Reb Velvel, where he has the whole long description of Reb Chaim's Derech HaLimud, is that Reb Chaim revolutionized certain areas of Shas. That before Reb Chaim, so it was known that there was a lot of lomdus, that there was depth, there was profundity, there was what to say in Noshim, in Nezikin. That Reb Chaim took certain topics, which beforehand the Rav used to say that Yeredeya before Reb Chaim was all pots and pans. And then Reb Chaim came along, and all of a sudden Yeredeya was just as deep and just as profound as Noshim and Nezikin. And one of the examples which the Rav there gives, Taka, is Shtaros. He says that before Reb Chaim, so there was no... You didn't have the lomdus in Shtaros, and Reb Chaim revolutionized that inyan. Certainly, in Yoni Orech Chaim, especially Tefillah and the like, there's no question that the Rav revolutionized more so than Reb Chaim. It's truer, much truer of him than it is of Reb Chaim in these areas. Revolutionized in Yonim, in Orech Chaim, in terms of revealing, again, the Rav said about Reb Chaim, that Reb Chaim brought lomdus to the Siddur, but it was even truer of himself than it was of Reb Chaim. In terms of tefillah needing a matir, and just so much, chidushim al gabi chidushim, which just totally transformed these chalkei Torah. And again, that's more than just an individual chiddush. It's a total transformation. It's not just a chiddush and a sugya, but a total transformation. The other answer, again, by no means these being the only answers, but the other answer is that the Rav had a tremendous, tremendous revolutionary effect in Machshava. How so? I'd like to very, very briefly try to describe it and maybe give one or two illustrations. You know, in his essay, Halachic Mind, so the Rav writes the following. To this end, there is only a single source from which a Jewish philosophical Weltanschauung, Hashkafa, can emerge. The objective order, the Halacha. Problems of freedom, I skipped a few lines, causality, God-man relationship, creation, and nihility would be illuminated by halachic principles. A new light could be shed on our apprehension of reality. The halachic compass would also guide us through the lanes of medieval philosophy. And then the Rav concludes with one of the most tantalizing lines ever written by one of Gedolei Yisrael. Out of the sources of halacha, a new world view awaits formulation. Now, basically what the Rav said And I'm not sure if we sufficiently appreciate to what degree he made good on this promise, is that the hashkafa of Torah, the hashkafa of Yahadus, the ultimate and most definitive sources for hashkafa, it's not we generally, right? If we're asked, so how do you hashkafa? Okay, so in Shas, there's halacha and agada, right? So we all know, those are the two chalkei Shas. So you want to know muta v'osa, tome v'toa, so you study halacha. You want to know hashkafa, so then you study the chalkei agada. And what the Rav, again, I think more than anyone, without exception, certainly in terms of what we have written, in terms of Svarim, which we have as part of our Masorah, what the Rav showed more than anyone is that the Hashkafa of Yahadus is latent in the Halacha. Now, give an example. And this is to be elicited, and this can't be overemphasized. It's to be elicited not by philosophizing about Halacha, but by learning halacha, again, the way you learn yesh dichoy about the nira v'nitcha, or dichoy me'ikara, the same way you learn that sugya. So you learn consistently like that, and again, the philosophy of Yahadus is to be extracted from halacha. I'll give you one example of where the Rav himself, again, without waving the red flag, so sometimes we miss it, did it. In the second volume of the Yahrzeit Shiurim, there's a wonderful, wonderful shiur about Mechikas Hashem. And in that shiur about Mechikas Hashem, so the Rav talks about the Gemara and Shavuos, the Machlokes Tanoim, about Osios Hanitpalos Lashem. What happens if you have prefixes or suffixes, again, right, which in Lashon HaKodesh, right, unlike English for the most part, where often the preposition is a separate word, so in Lashon HaKodesh, so the preposition is a prefix. It's la, it's mem. So what happens if you have a prefix or a suffix attached to the Shem Hashem, Leilokim or Elokeichem? So whether or not these osios hanitpalos Hashem have kedushas Hashem and therefore there's an isur mechika or not. So one view in the Tanoim, which is how we paskin, distinguishes between the prefix and the suffix. That nitpalos Hashem milafonov doesn't have kedushas Hashem, but nitpalos Hashem milachorov does have a kedushas Hashem. So that's halacha, right? Halacha, straight and simple. No agada. The Rav explains so beautifully, you have to take a look at it, so beautifully, he explains that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to Avraham Avinu and says, V'hayisi l'cha u'lezaracha acharecha le'lokim, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that even though I, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, am absolute, right? Absolute in that my existence is absolute, I'm totally independent, but nevertheless, I am going to allow myself to be defined in terms of you and your children. And that will become, right, kaviyochol, I'll be identified that way. And it's because of that revolution of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship with Klal Yisrael, that's why the Osios Hanitpolos, Lashem Milachorev, Elokeichem, Elokei, have Kedushas Hashem. The prefix which you put in front, that doesn't reflect HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship with us. However, the suffix, right? What's the suffix? Elokeichem, Elokeinu, right? Those are the suffixes which express the relationship of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to us. So that has a Kedushas Hashem. Why? Because Vayisi L'chal Elokim. And that's the Elokei Haaretz, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, again, that's the ultimate chesed which HaKadosh Baruch Hu bestowed, that I, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, again, whose existence is absolute, is independent, so I am making myself known as Elokeichem. And that's why that has a Kedushas Hashem. I can guarantee you that when the Rav wrote this line about how from the sources of Halacha, problems of God-man relationship, so he certainly had in mind this Torah about Mechikas Hashem. And in that respect, again, this was an absolutely revolutionary contribution to Machshava. This notion, and again, it's with all the rigor and the normal method of learning halacha. It's not taking liberties. It's not philosophizing about halacha. It's with the same, again, rigor, the same derech halimud as the Yayor Shalom Yidas. But again, when applied to certain sugyas, it reveals again a hashkafas olam. And kohena v'chahena in the Rav's chidushin, so many of them, again, actually, at least in part, deliver on this promise of revealing, again, philosophy of a hashkafas olam from within sources of halacha. I'd like to finally, if you'll just, with your permission, just touch on, again, and just to repeat for those who weren't here at the beginning, it was impossible, even with someone whose organizational skills are better than mine, and someone who would speak at a faster clip, it's impossible to give any kind of comprehensive portrait of the Rav in an hour. So these are just isolated, again, maybe even fragmented points. But the last point which I would like to discuss is the Rav's relationship to what's called modern orthodoxy. So, first of all, for the most part, the term almost didn't exist in his lexicon. When the Rav would talk about what the Torah's position on something was, what his understanding of the Torah's position was, so he didn't even talk about orthodoxy. Halachas kama v'kama, he didn't talk about orthodoxy with an adjective in front of it. He would talk about the halacha. That was his favorite, most common term that he used. Sometimes he would talk about, he would say Yahdus, he would say Yiddishkeit. This notion of self-definition apart from the Torah community as a whole, that wasn't the way he spoke. That wasn't his vernacular in terms of self-identification. In terms of what conventionally, what colloquially is referred to as modern orthodoxy, so it's very important to understand what the Rav's so-called modernity consisted of. This is something which, for whatever reasons, and there are different reasons in different contexts, is often misunderstood and misrepresented. I think the way my father, Zichron Levacha, once described it was that the Rav engaged modernity on his own terms. What does that mean? And if you look, the Chumash Drashos, recently republished in English translation, they were originally Yiddish Drashos. The Rav talks a lot about these things. The Rav believed very strongly, very passionately, that Torah could and would overcome every challenge, and that to try to retreat ultimately was doomed to failure. And the Rav felt that if people were told that you have to make a choice between remaining true to Torah and between being able to integrate economically into modern society, he thought that too many Jews would be lost. If you told them that you can't remain a Ma'amin, you can't remain a Ben Torah, and also get the education which is going to let you be a lawyer, let you be a scientist, let you be a businessman with an MBA, so the Rav felt that there were going to be too few Jews inside this insular area, and too many Jews who would be left outside. And that's what the Rav used to say about the 14th Animam, and he didn't mean it literally, obviously, because really what he was saying is included in the Animam of Zosa Torah Lo Sehei Mukhlefes, Lo Sehei Torah Acheres Meis HaBor Yisbarach Shemo, is that Torah can be lived, studied, fulfilled, followed, b'chol makom u'b'chol zman, in the laboratories, in the boardrooms, everywhere. And that was his vision. But that wasn't a vision of compromise. It was a vision of doing it on our own terms, that one could, again, be steeped enough in Torah, and one could sift, and one could meet the challenges of being a lawyer, of being in the boardroom, with 100% loyalty to halacha, without compromising on a kutzo shel yud, on a kutzo shel yud. So if modernity meant not sticking your head in the sand, if it meant confronting modernity, even engaging it, but on one's own terms, so if that's what to be modern means, so then he certainly was modern. If modern means that somehow or other you reshape things, that you reinterpret things, so that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case at all. The one place which I'm familiar where the Rav uses the term modern orthodoxy, so he uses it very critically in his hesped for Reb Chaim Heller, when the Rav describes how he would go visit Reb Chaim Heller, who lived on the west side. So he said he would feel like he was going from one world to another world, that he left one year, he would leave one universe when he would leave the west side and go into that enclave, which was Reb Chaim Heller's apartment. So he felt that he was going out of one rishus into another rishus. And he said he felt like he was leaving the rishus of Orthodoxia HaModernit, Ktzutzat HaKnafayim, Larum Of, Unetulat HaShor Hashem, Lachdor LaOmek HaChavaya HaDatit. That he was leaving behind the modern Orthodoxy, literally whose wings have been clipped, so that it can't soar, and it doesn't have the roots to penetrate to the depth of religious experience. The Rav was very critical of the excessive materialism and superficiality that exists in our community. And the Rav certainly believed very much and devoted countless time to this, in the indispensability of Torah leadership. He devoted much time to the RCA, which in his lifetime was a very powerful force, precisely because of his involvement, because of his leadership. The Rav's encouragement of individuality wasn't at the expense of recognizing that Klal Yisrael is supposed to be led by Gedolei Torah. His understanding of individuality, here's a true story which is typical of that. Someone once called the Rav, that his son told him he wants to leave yeshiva, and he was interested in a certain blue-collar profession. Honest, but not my son the doctor, right? Not even a white-collar professional, achas kama v'kama, not rabbonus v'chinuch. So the Rav, and the father wanted to resist and wanted to force him. So the Rav knew this person and knew that he wasn't cut out for Rabbonus. He knew that it would be a disaster, and that if anything, it would have potential to turn him off. That if he did what Masha Libo Chafetz, he would be a firm balabas, who was kovei itim laTorah, and if he was forced into a mold where he didn't fit, so then Rachmana Litzlan, it could have alienated him. So he told this person, you know what, tell him to do it, but tell him he has to get the proper training so that he can succeed. And the father remains indebted to the Rav ad Hayom Hazeh. So that's what the Rav's understanding for individuality was. But it's not at all the case that the Rav thought that everyone should be deciding what's right, what's wrong, even in those areas, again, Kayodua, where the Rav said on military matters that you have to get military expertise. So the Rav said that is a psak. Now, it was the Rav's psak that I don't have the expertise to do it. But it was the prerogative of the Rav to make that judgment that this is something which requires the medical expertise of the doctor, that this is something which required the military expertise of generals, of military experts. It wasn't a retreat, a withdrawal, an abandonment. It was rather saying no, that there are halachas where a rav has to take the expert opinion of people in the field. Again, be it in medical matters, be it in military matters. But that was the psak. That was the psak. So it's very important to understand. The Rav's, again, his affinity with what we call modern orthodoxy, which should be the self-perception and the self-definition, was an unwavering support for Medinas Yisrael, recognition of Medinas Yisrael as a tremendous nes and chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam. It was the recognition, again, of not forcing everyone into a single mold. And that's what when the Rav would talk about Talmidim, so men Talmidim, yeah, they had their individual identities. If this Talmud was destined to be a Rav, to be a Machanich, so be it. If the other one didn't have the Kishronos, didn't have the temperament, so don't force him into the same mold. But it wasn't this sense of whatever you want, this sense of relativism and subjectivism, which is sometimes portrayed. That's not at all the case, and that's not what his, again, encounter with modernity was about. And ultimately, I think it's fair to say, and it's something which is worth thought on all our parts, and deep thought, that the future of the community which looked to the Rav as its Moreh Derech, as its Gadol, will depend, and whether or not it remains, again, not only whether it can thrive, but whether it even remains viable, will depend to what extent, again, the Torah leadership of the Rav is not available. It's not available anywhere. It's not to be had today. But Yiftach B'Doro Ki Shmuel B'Doro. So the Rav was a Shmuel B'Doro. So I don't know whether we'll ever see the likes of that again. I certainly would like to, but I don't anticipate seeing it in my lifetime. But nevertheless, in order for that community to continue again, not only to thrive, but even to be viable, it still has to have, again, the Torah leadership which the Rav, again, provided and steered. I know that there was someone who used to teach here, Rabbi Louis Bernstein, Olav HaShalom. So he wrote a very interesting book. He wrote a history of the RCA. It's a very interesting book. Mission and Challenge and Mission, something like that. And you look, just look in the index for where the Rav's name appears, and read those pages in the book. And it's fascinating to see where, again, orthodoxy would have been and where it ended up because of the Rav. You really get a sense from that book of how, again, the leadership which he exercised and the influence which he had, how it kept the community on its course, and the future of that community depends, again, upon maintaining that type of influence and leadership.